Chapter 11. Someone had to go and speak to a CID training course, and I was pleased it was my turn. There are a lot of police courses, and officers have no choice about attending. But some make it obvious they would rather be playing golf, or even out on the job, than sitting in a lecture hall. I was sure of getting their attention today, however, because my subject was the human body after death. The police are seldom present when someone dies. They inevitably arrive after the event, sometimes a long time afterwards. This lecture was designed to help them recognize what they might find. I began by explaining that death is a process, and when that process, dying, is complete, it sets off another series of processes which eventually return us to the earth and complete the life cycle. The screen lit up above me and the police officers stretched out their legs. A few sipped their coffee and relaxed, with the air of men settling down with their wives to watch a David Attenborough wildlife documentary. I didn't want to give them too much science, so I simply said that oxygen is vital for almost all cells. It facilitates the cell's multitude of life-sustaining chemical reactions. This is metabolism. On death, when there is no oxygen, muscle cells rapidly become flaccid. They may, for some hours, still respond to touch, or the discharge of a dying motor neuron cell, or other forms of stimulation. As a result, disconcertingly, limbs may even twitch in a lifeless body. The eyelids may close, or more often half close, because muscles in the eyelid are too flaccid to complete the movement. The response to light is lost. However, there is a myth in some cultures, predominantly Asian, but also in the West, that the eyes retain the final image they see, so exposing the face of their killer. This was considered as a scientific possibility in Europe in the 1870s. It was called optography, and experiments were performed on individuals before and after execution, but without success. Despite the lack of any scientific proof, the concept took root in the public imagination, thanks in part to authors such as Rudyard Kipling and Jules Verne, who used it in short stories. The idea even featured in an episode of Doctor Who in the 1970s. Once cemented in the public psyche, it has been very difficult to remove. Another old wives' tale is that hair continues to grow after death. In fact, the cells in hair follicles die with the rest of the skin. The skin, if the deceased is Caucasian, becomes pale on death because blood is not circulating and blood pressure is lost. The rings of muscle that control the passage of food and liquid through the digestive system lose their tone, which means that, depending on both the angle of the body and the individual's internal organs, urine may leak out. Feces also, but this is less common because of the structure of the rectum. Another common leak is that of semen, so it is never safe for the pathologist to assume, on finding semen outside the body, that the deceased had sex just before he died, although he might have done. And just because gastric contents are found in the mouth, there can be no assumption that vomiting was a cause of death, since regurgitation is found in about 25% of postmortems. The police officers really did not need reminding that death can be a messy business. They knew that bodies often leak from orifices in a way their owners would find shameful in life. In fact, I long ago understood, after talking to people about their end-of-life fears, that this undignified leakage is something many find worrying about death. But I believe there is no need for anxiety. Those of us who choose to work with the dead are non-judgmental and respectful, and I feel that worriers really won't care about this when life is actually draining away from them. I think they will be entirely involved in the process of letting go and giving up their bodies. Embarrassment is just the kind of worldly concern which I believe the dying relinquish, often perhaps with relief. The next process after death is cooling. I could have devoted an entire lecture to this subject, but I offered only the most general of guidelines. I wanted the police officers to recognize how unrealistic TV movies are about judging the time of death accurately from a body's temperature. The next process is the stiffening of the muscles known as rigor mortis. They were familiar with that one. Then I showed pictures of hypostasis. On death, blood stops circulating and its components, cells, and protein become subject to the normal laws of gravity, which means that the red blood cells sink and settle in the lowest areas of the body. The tiny blood vessels in the skin in those areas then become distended by blood. This makes the skin initially appear pink, but within 5 or 6 hours it turns a very angry colour, bright pink with a bluish tinge. And here is the paint box we call hypostasis. Its alarming appearance is heightened in Caucasians by the great whiteness of adjacent parts of the body, those which are pressed against a firm surface, a bed or the floor perhaps, where the blood vessels are squashed flat and so cannot fill. These areas stay blanched. A Caucasian who dies lying in bed, therefore, has hypostasis staining most of the skin on the back, as well as the back of the neck, thighs and lower legs, and very white skin on the buttocks, as well as white patches over the shoulders. In darker-skinned people, hypostasis is, of course, still present, but its appearance is much less livid. Hypostasis does eventually disappear, but only when the blood is dispersed by the final process after death. This process is decomposition. Many people find the idea of decomposition repellent. It might help to remember that this is an important, natural process that completes the life cycle of the human body and returns it to the chemical pool that is the earth. It is hard to imagine what our world would be like without the ultimately cleansing process of decomposition, smelly and ugly though it may seem to the living. There are 3 ways a body can decompose: by putrefaction, mummification, or adipocere, of which putrefaction is by far the most common. I had brought pictures, and the officers seemed unaffected by those I had shown so far. But I watched them sit up now, hoping, I guessed, they wouldn't have to look at putrefaction. But a putrefying body is simply one in which the soft tissues are turning slowly to liquid. The speed of this process, of course, depends on temperature. In the UK, bodies will usually start to putrefy around 3 or 4 days after death, and this will be visible to the naked eye quickly. I showed a picture of a body and, with a pointer, drew the officer's attention to one small area of green discoloration just on the right side of the lower abdomen. "It's usually just there," I said. "That's where you'll first see putrefaction." Our guts are full of bacteria, which are vital for digestion. Now, in death, those bacteria break out of the bowel and into the abdominal cavity and then the blood vessels. The process starts at this certain point on the abdomen, near the appendix, because the abdominal wall is very close to the intestine here. Putrefaction can begin elsewhere, but only with good reason. For example, if a body is lying across a heating pipe, or part of it is in direct sunlight. Wherever it begins, by the time the green blotch is visible on the skin, then the bacteria are running riot inside the body. The blood vessels provide easy channels for the bacteria to spread, causing the hemoglobin there to decompose. Visible result? The extraordinary and beautiful fern-like patterns of the veins closest to the surface becomes clearly etched on the skin as though tattooed in brown. It is often evident on the arms and thighs. I think the police officers were beginning to realise now that this was no David Attenborough documentary. But like every death process, this rather beautiful stage is temporary. Gradually the pattern is lost as the skin blisters into red and brown fluid. As the blisters burst, the skin sloughs off. One waste product of all this bacterial activity is gas, and so now the body begins to swell. First, the genitals become bloated, followed by the face, abdomen and breasts. Then eyes and tongue protrude as bloody liquid is forced up from the lungs, leaking from nose and mouth. The face, with its popping eyes and tongue, has a look of amazement. Those officers who could look at the screen, and many chose not to, stared back at the body I showed them with equal amazement. Swelling bodies at this stage of decomposition become so dark that anyone finding one can wrongly assume a skinny Caucasian was in life an overweight black man. Flies have a role to play in putrefaction by feasting and laying their eggs, which turn into maggots with voracious appetites. Animals, domestic and wild, may also make an important contribution to bodily breakdown. Outside, there are rats and foxes, and inside, well, yes, a starving dog which finds itself locked in the house after a death will probably eat its owner to survive. Within about a week of death, depending as usual on the weather and microenvironment, body cavities will burst and tissues will start to liquefy. Within about a month, the soft tissues are all liquid, and these will drain off into the ground. The usual order of decomposition is first the intestines, stomach, liver, blood and heart. then the lungs and air passages, next the brain, then the kidneys and bladder, finally the muscles. The prostate, the uterus, the tendons and the ligaments are relatively resistant to putrefaction and may not break down for months to leave the skeleton stripped. I didn't show any pictures of this final part of the process. They looked as though they'd seen enough. A much more unusual form of decomposition in this country is mummification. Mummified bodies are brown and dry. The skin is drawn tightly over the skeleton so it looks shriveled and tough like leather. This process dries the tissues, hardening them in a way that prevents putrefaction. It usually requires hot, desert-like conditions. Bodies buried in the sands of Egypt may even mummify spontaneously. In the UK, mummification can happen if a thin person, the thin are more likely to cool and desiccate quickly, dies in a very dry and drafty place, an attic or chimney, for instance. It's rare to find a mummified body now, but not so long ago they were encountered relatively often. Anyone here seen a mummified body outside the British Museum? I asked my audience. A few raised their hands. One of the older officers said, "Baby, been hidden in the attic, and not yesterday either. Years and years ago, probably during the war," they said, "because it happened a lot then." "Was it a newborn?" I asked. He nodded. I had actually recently seen a mummified newborn myself, and the circumstances had been the same. The bodies of newborn babies are relatively sterile, which makes them less susceptible to putrefaction and more likely to mummify. Those babies were generally born in secret to single mothers in the days when this was truly shameful. Either they were born dead, or they died at birth as the mother struggled to cope alone, or they were actually killed. But in many cases, burial was apparently not an option, and so the body would be hidden under the floorboards or in the attic. As social attitudes to birth outside marriage changed, these discoveries decreased. But in the 1980s, they still sometimes happened when old ladies died and young couples bought their houses for renovation, to find, in the loft, the tragic, long-hidden, mummified corpse of a tiny baby. There are a few examples of adult homicides, revealed years later by the discovery of a mummified body. Most famous is a case in Wales where a strangled woman was hidden in a cupboard for years while her family continued to claim her pension. Once completely dried, a mummified body can last a long time, but eventually mold forms and the dried tissues gradually become powdery and disintegrate. The mummy very often attracts rodents, beetles and moths too. However, if it is recovered in time, it can very faithfully reveal through preserved bruises, abrasions or other injuries the cause of death. The third process of decomposition is adipocere, a rare chemical change in the body's saturated fat which hydrolyzes it, stiffening and swelling it into a waxy compound, a bit like soap. It's sometimes called corpse wax or the wax of graveyards. Basically, the body, or part of it, is preserved looking as though it is a waxwork. In the UK, the process of adipocere formation takes about 6 months, although I've heard of a case just 3 weeks after death that presumably was aided by the sun's heat and the warmth of maggot infestation. Adipocere requires damp conditions. In its early stages, when the fat is hydrolyzed into a greasy semi-fluid, the rancid smell is terrible. But as the process progresses, the fat becomes brittle and paler, and when the adipocere is fully formed, it's grey and firm. The phenomenon of adipocere has been documented for many years, and it can last literally centuries. Otzi, the Neolithic hunter, known as the Glacier Man, whose body is on display in Bolzano in the Italian Dolomites, was probably at least partly preserved this way. In the 18th century, excavations at the Cimetière des Innocents in Paris allegedly yielded tons of adipocere, and it was promptly put to use by the city's soap and candle makers. There were some famous cases in the 1970s from Australia where the process perfectly preserved the form, if not the contents, of divers' bodies found about a year after they drowned due to equipment failure as they explored a deep freshwater lake. On occasions, adipocere has revealed a cause of death, perfectly reproducing injuries like bullet holes or preserving the fat in certain organs. In general, it's more commonly found in women, the well-nourished and the obese, but conditions have to be right. Usually the body must have been submerged in water anaerobically or buried in a damp grave. especially if there is no coffin, and especially if the deceased is wearing natural and not synthetic fibres. Its formation can be influenced by the season, the depth of the grave, coffin composition, the soil, and the local insect activity. These three processes of decomposition, putrefaction, mummification, and adipocere, are not mutually exclusive. All three could, in theory, be found in different areas of the same body, although that would be extraordinary as each requires such different conditions. But two processes have been found together, and putrefaction is always one of them. Although it is common now to short-circuit the natural rotting processes I have described by cremation, the traditional place for human remains in this country is the cemetery. Burial tends to delay decomposition. In fact, a body above ground is said to decompose at least four times faster than one buried. Underground, it probably takes 2 years for the soft tissues to disappear completely. Tendons, ligaments, hair and nails will be identifiable for some time after that. In about 5 years, the bones are bare and disarticulated, but there are often fragments of cartilage, and if I use a high-speed saw to cut the bones of bodies that have been exhumed after 5 years, there is a wisp of smoke caused by scorched protein still in the marrow and the smell of burning organic matter, something I can also expect from the bones of the recently dead. The human skeleton is the last part of the body to return to the earth, which of course can take a very long time. Hominid bones more than 2 million years old have been found in dry parts of the world. Unless preserved anaerobically in a bog, the damp UK climate does not keep bones so well, and eventually all bones must decompose. Wet soils that hold water hasten this by leaching the calcium and other minerals away. As the bone becomes more porous, the process of disintegration is helped by bacteria, fungi, and even plants thrusting their roots inside the cracks and crevices and breaking up the bone more, as well as by gnawing animals. Throughout their careers, pathologists are approached by the police to examine bones. I asked the attendees if anyone had submitted found bones to a pathologist, and two people put up their hands. Usually, just one bone is found, sometimes a collection, and they are nearly always from animals, but not always. All pathologists have files labelled old bones, and every attempt is made to identify these finds. Some bones, like the pelvis or the skull, tell us at a glance whether its owner was male or female. Other bones, and particularly teeth, can tell us the age of the deceased if they were very young or very old. Otherwise, judging age from a skeleton is not a precise science. For the most part, our old bones files remain mysterious. Our main task is to date the bones and discover whether this death, possibly a criminal death, occurred in the last 60 or 70 years, in which case the killer might still be alive. Dating is a specialist skill. Carbon-14 dating only works to a very long timescale, but the atomic bombs of the 1940s, with their release of strontium-90 into the atmosphere, mean it is relatively easy to discover whether bones pre- or post-date these explosions. If they predate the atomic era, the police are seldom interested, although archaeologists might be. At the end of the talk, most of the officers made a dash for the bar. There was an orchestra of cigarette lighters clicking outside the door. One detective did approach me, however. He was the older man who had been involved with the case of the mummified baby. "Thanks for that, Doc," he said. "I've been haunted by that baby, and by another one, a body which had been sitting in his armchair for almost a year when we found him. I dream about them sometimes. But when you talk about the science of it, well, that made me feel a bit better. I even found I could look at the pictures you showed us today." This was a rare example of an officer of that era admitting to vulnerabilities, and his words stayed with me. I resolved to redouble my efforts to talk during postmortems. I should not just say whatever came into my head, but present the body in a detached, scientific way, which would help onlookers quash the very unscientific emotions they might be feeling.